This is the MagicWordPodcast.com.
Hello, this is Scott Wells for the MagicWordPodcast.com. This week we're going to be taking a really deep dive into the ancient art of magic. And when I say ancient art, we're going to go back as far as we can. We're going to be visiting with Dr. Stefan Taut from Dresden, Germany. And he is a well-known expert on a lot of Egyptian magic, as well as Hieronymus Bosch and the painting called The Juggler, which we know better as The Conjurer nowadays. Anyhow, we're going to get into that here a little bit later. A lot of stuff to talk about here this week. And I wanted to, first of all, just remind everybody that if you haven't been watching the Masters of Illusion television series, that's going to be, I think, season 10, the second half of season 10 is going to be kicking off here, coming up later this month. That's going to be on June the 20th. And then we'll be, I believe that's on a Friday, and then it will be every Friday thereafter, actually running with the new episodes through August the 29th. And it starts at 9 o'clock. It's a half-hour show, 9 to 9:30 Eastern time in the U.S. Anyhow, just thought I would throw that out there just so that way you can kind of set your DVRs and get ready to know there's another new season. Actually, I say that's their 10th season. They've actually been on the air for 21 seasons, but it has been on other networks. Anyhow, we've talked about this in the past, but I just thought I would bring it up to bring your attention to that then as well. Well, as we have said before, or I should say as Eugene Berger perhaps is better well known for have saying, there are many rooms in the House of Magic. Certainly, this is an area of magic history where there are a lot of people who hang out in this room. And they may only just be collectors, or they may be historians or whatever. The guest this week was introduced to me by my friend Richard Hatch when I was at Long Beach at the Magic Collectors Expo recently, and I found we had a mutual connection almost immediately due to the art we have enjoyed over the years and pursued our research into the art of Hieronymus Bosch independently of each other, but both have just a fascination with it that we're going to share here this week then as well. But beyond that, he goes back in the first part of this episode in talking about the conjurer known as Jetty, or we might know as Dedi, D-E-D-I, but D-J-E-D-I, Jetty, who was a court, I say conjurer, he was a court magician then for Pharaoh many, you know, thousands of years before Christ, and also some other court magicians and some debunking some myths. There have been some recent developments, and I say recent over the last 200 years or so, that have redefined what our knowledge is of what we thought was certain things. We also talk about Beni Hassan, the tomb where supposedly there are a couple of guys doing cups and balls. And so we get into detail about that. That was some artwork that was on the hieroglyphics of Beni Hassan's tomb. Anyhow, and then bringing that up to date through Hieronymus Bosch, and the correct way of pronouncing that is boss, like be a boss. So rather than Bosch, even though it looks like that. Anyhow, we get into the weeds on this pretty deep, and I have an interest in art because my original major when I went to college was in art, and then studied art history and loved going to museums, and particularly, well, magic art, but art in general, I guess. And actually, I have given a few scholarly talks in museums to curators who were going out and wanting to know more information about Hieronymus Bosch. So I have lectured also to a few magic clubs about this painting then as well. It's very fascinating. If you start getting involved in it, it's just a never-ending abyss, I guess, and just it's a fun place to go, and I've enjoyed it, and I really enjoyed my talk here this week with my guest. If you like art history, or if you like history of magic, I know that you're going to get a lot out of this. It's like going back to school and sitting in a lecture hall and listening to the teacher talk about the history of magic and in particular some magic art. So I know you're going to learn a lot. I hope you enjoy this as much as I enjoyed it. Again, it gets a little bit deep, and these are things in which we didn't have these things in front of us. We were just recalling these pictures from our minds because we spent so much time looking at it and studying these. So anyhow, I'm going to shut up and introduce my guest here this week. Please welcome my guest from Dresden, Dr. Stefan Tout, here on The Magic Order. Today, I'm with someone who is an expert, a scholarly expert, actually, on antiquities, magic antiquities of many nations, and particularly having to do with Djedi and the Westcott Papyrus. We're going to talk about Hieronymus Bosch, or Bosch. We're going to talk about how that's pronounced properly, and the Conjurer, which was a popular, well-known painting that most magicians know about. And he's from Dresden, Germany, and we've got him then right now. Here he is, Dr. Stefan Tout.
So, hello.
Tout. Tout. Yeah. Got it then right. That's correct.
Yes.
So, your English is good. I know that you say
it's not good.
It's not good.
I try to understand, and I will speak slowly, which I usually do not.
I don't either.
But
I don't speak slowly.
I speak fast. Slowly, then I have more time to think about the language.
Good. Understood. No problem. One of the things I want to talk about is obviously Hieronymus Bosch. As I have heard this, is the correct pronunciation for his name Boss or Bosch or Boss?
Boss.
It is Boss.
In Netherlands, they would say Boss.
And that's the name of a town where he was from, isn't that right?
That's Sertogenbosch.
Okay, yeah. Sertogenbosch.
The G and the H, it is pronounced Sertogenbosch, like Van Gogh, the famous painter.
Yeah.
It's not Van Gogh, not Van Gogh, it is Van Gogh. That's the same.
We always say Van Gogh, obviously.
Yeah, yeah. Sertogenbosch. I learned that from Flip, actually. I asked him.
I love Flip. He's been a guest of my home, great friends. Yeah, if you happen to see him next time, please say hello for me. I love that man. And in fact, speaking of art, he has impressed me. So, gosh, I get goosebumps just thinking about this. When he stayed with me, we went to the museum one day, and he was saying, "Oh, I know, I remember this artist, or I knew him, or I studied this one," or he just knew so much about all that. It was just fascinating to speak with someone because I love museums, I love art, and that's why I was anxious to speak with you about your specialty in magic antiquities in particular. Yeah. Is there some particular one, before we get more into Boss, about something that you have spent the most time with, or an article you've written, or a book? What is your specialty?
That is easy to answer.
Yeah.
I started in 2005 with research, with a deep research in the, papyrus Westcott, not Westcott papyrus, because the Egyptologists all over the world, they call it the papyrus Westcott.
Papyrus Westcott.
So, okay. And that is, I know that now, the oldest record of a trick performance, not for entertaining purposes. The entertainment is the second level there. There is entertainment, but it was not performed for entertainment. They used tricks to show the king that the performer, who is called, his name was Djedi, that he is able to produce or to make predictions in the future.
Mm-hmm.
The king wanted to know whether this guy is really has that knowledge, has the power to make true predictions.
Yeah.
And to convince the king, he showed tricks.
Yes.
That's it. So, and to keep the record straight at that time, this is not a record. It is a story. It is old Egyptian literature, because in that time, we speak about 1550 before Christ. Mm-hmm. In that time, the papyrus was written. The story is old, about 200 years older, but the papyrus was written about 2550 before Christ.
In Egyptian hieroglyphics.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So, and what was the beginning of the sentence?
Oh. We're talking about how that he was not necessarily entertaining the king.
No, he was no entertainer. That is absolutely sure. If you analyze the papyrus, he was in the top level of the hierarchy, slightly below the king.
Okay.
And because we have mentioned in the papyrus some entertainers in the same story,
which got a much, much lower salary than the Jedi. Mm-hmm. We can really exclude that Jedi is depicted in the story as entertainer. So I come back, why did I tell that? Because at that time, there was a whole corpus of literature already in Egypt. Mm-hmm. So we have no record here. It is a piece of literature. It's a story, more or less.
So it's to be considered as a parable, not as something that actually happened.
Yeah.
Correct me if I'm wrong then also, was he the one who cut off the head of
exactly.
a duck and exchanged
That's it.
Places?
That's it.
Okay.
So he cut off, no, he teared off.
He tore the head. Off, okay.
Oh, he tore off, he yeah,
yes.
thank you. He tore off the head of a goose.
Yes.
Put the head on that side of the Great Hall.
Correct.
The remaining of the goose, and that then they went together and reunited. That is written in the story.
Yes.
And later he performed the same effect with another bird, not a goose, and also with a bull.
A bull?
A bull was the, wow. the head was cut off.
Okay.
But that actually is, again, difficult because they did not, or they do not write that the head was cut off. They simply say the head was
removed.
Or the head fell down.
Okay.
So, oh. and I'm not sure whether this is true. I believe, or at least it is a solution to explain this special wording, which is really strange, that Jedi used a simple rope penetration through the neck to prove that he cut off the head
I see.
And put it again onto the body.
But it was still separated by yeah, pulling yeah. the rope through
no,
and he was showing
it. If not, it was not separate. It's a very short part of the story
uh-huh.
with the bull, which is suspicious because the effect with the bull is much more impressive with two as in comparison to, with the birds. So that's why this is only a very short sentence.
Hmm.
It takes a long story for the bird, but
yes.
for the more impressive effect with the bull,
it's
a very
short
sentence.
Uh-huh.
So and therefore it's only a hypothesis, of course. It's only a hypothesis, but might be that the author of the story saw a similar effect with the rope penetration of through a net of a bull, through the neck of the bull.
Completely separate from...
Yeah, of course.
I understand
if
what you're saying.
Interested in that, I ask you to read the Gibecier, which was published in... Well, this was the winter issue in 2023.
Okay.
There is in detail... explained.
Now, the Gibecier, for people who are listening and are not familiar with that, that is mm-hmm. A regular publication that the Conjuring Art Society puts out, that Bill Kalush
yeah.
Publishes, the
yeah.
Gibecier, which, by the way, Gibecier, of course, is the pouch that a street magician wears, just complete the rest of that story. As far as the bull, it seems like I heard that there is an illusion that was made like that, and I believe Richard Garriott had that, because I was talking with Brad Henderson. I think he told me that they had like a bull that was supposed to be a trick that was based upon that sentence or so
Maybe.
They were talking about that. So in other words, it was inspired by that, which is something, of course, that magicians are still trying to do. I believe was it Keller who was decapitating himself, or had a poster like with that, yeah. and some others where they're trying to show where they can cut off their head or exchange heads. Or I remember Andre Cole had something like
that
too.
The exchange of the heads is actually a very, very interesting story. One of the most famous who performed the cutting of two heads. Heads of two birds, and then to exchange the heads
yes.
was Bartolomeo Bosco from Italy.
Oh, Bosco did that.
Yeah,
okay,
Bosco
yeah.
did that. It was a famous. It was famous for trick. It was a famous trick.
It was on the
by
it was,
him.
It was on their poster.
Exactly.
Yeah.
We have a poster, and therefore it must be important.
Yes,
it must have been important for him.
Sure.
Otherwise, he would not put it onto the poster.
Sure.
And then we come to a very, very interesting fact. In the 1850s already, Bosco planted a story. If it's true or not, I have no idea.
Mm-hmm.
That he performed exactly that trick with the two birds in front of the Turkish Sultan.
The Turkish Sultan, okay.
Yeah, so, and he asked Bosco to repeat the trick with two slaves.
Two human slaves,
with a black one and a white one. And Bosco then, of course, could not perform that, and therefore, with an excuse, he left the court. And that is a direct parallel to the Papyrus Vesca story, because also Jetty, after he performed the before he performed the effect with the two birds,
yes,
he was first asked to perform the trick, the decapitation trick or the decapitation wonder, with a sentenced prisoner, and Jetty refused.
Okay,
and then you have to know, in that time, the story plays at the court of Cheops.
Cheops.
The story plays at the court of Cheops. That is about 1,000 years earlier than the story was written on papyrus.
Oh.
Yeah. Cheops lived at about 1,500 before Christ. Mm-hmm. And the story was written at about 1,500 before Christ. And and the story stems from 1,700 before Christ. Even then, it's 800 years time distance.
Yes.
So, and at the time of Cheops, it was completely impossible to refuse an order of the king.
Mm-hmm.
That was not possible. That was no option for nobody.
Right.
So, but the story tells that. And that, by the way, is one of the hints which tells that Jetty was very, very high ranked.
Okay. That in the king's court.
That he had the freedom to refuse an order of the king.
Now, that I had thought about that.
No entertainer, for sure. No,
because he would have been put to death.
Yeah.
Otherwise, yeah. So,
yeah, yeah.
Interesting.
So, but now back, the effect was played in the 19th century. It is even earlier explained. I guess the first explanation of the bird decapitation trick in German language was in the 18th century, maybe in the 17th. I'm not sure. I have to check that. And at about the same time, it was explained in a Japanese book.
Okay.
At different parts of the world. So
for the king's court for also.
No. The trick. The explanation of
the
trick.
Pardon me. The explanation of
not
the trick.
Not the performance. Okay. That's the explanation of the trick. In the German book, I think it's in the 18th century. And at the same time, more or less the same time, also in Japanese. So I can say there is no connection between these two books. And therefore, we know for sure it was invented in several parts of the world independently. And then I can draw easily the conclusion, a people which is able to build pyramids 5,000 years ago.
Right.
That will be so intelligent to invent a magic trick.
I would think so. If they can build a pyramid, you're right. I mean, and move these blocks however they did.
This is really amazing.
That a magic trick would be insignificant compared to this. Surely they can do that then also.
I'm quite sure.
So are you saying that it actually happened, or that is a story that's supposed to be like a parable? I mean,
only a parable.
Okay, so many things like in the Bible, for an example, that people believe are true, but they're stories.
You can compare that.
Okay, yes, I understand. Okay. And so that was something, again, that was written in hieroglyphs, someplace like on the walls or on a pyramid or something?
On papyrus.
Always on papyrus. Of course it was. That was when you said. So that was stored
it's a story.
So. But I mean, no. It was stored, the papyrus itself.
In a tomb, probably.
Exactly.
We do not know. We do not know because the buyer of the papyrus was Henry Vesca. And from that name, the papyrus is called Papyrus Vesca. Henry Vesca was more or less a rich tourist from England who visited Egypt at the end of the first third of the 19th century. And there's also a diary. We have a diary of that travel there. At no page, he mentions the acquisition of the papyrus. Mm-hmm. At no page. That means it was not important to him.
Apparently not.
It was not important to him. Hmm. So there's one page he says, okay, when he visited some tombs in Kurna, that is, it is at the Nile Valley, and there he said, "Okay, I pleased my tour guides.
My tour guides,
I pleased my tour guides, and maybe he paid there some money for this papyrus. So if that is true, then the papyrus would stem from that area.
I see,
but that's only hypothesis. Mm-hmm. We do not know. We do not know where it actually comes from. There is a hypothesis that it comes from the Thebes from Thebes. The Thebes area, but it's only a hypothesis.
Mm-hmm. But the family didn't tell. I mean, Westcott's family didn't know, no, and if they knew, they're not telling.
No information about that.
Well, that's interesting then, too. Going back to that, since you're a scholar of that era then as well, one of the things is the cups and balls that people talk about, and some people say, well, they were bakers, it could be, or whatever. And when that goes back, I think, to Cheops, too, doesn't
it? It's later. So this is... Cheops lived in the Old Kingdom.
Okay.
And after the Old Kingdom went down economically. And then the next period is the first intermediate period. And if I'm correctly informed, these tombs in the southern part of the Nile, where this famous picture is with these two cups,
yes,
that stems from this first intermediate period, which is hundreds of years after Cheops.
After Cheops.
Yeah. It's hundreds,
Xerxes,
hundreds
of, maybe?
I'm not, no. I have to look for that, okay. But I think maybe 1800s before Christ.
Mm-hmm.
So it's earlier than the Papyrus Vesca, hundreds of years earlier than the Papyrus Vesca, but it has absolutely no connection with magic.
That really, you're convinced that it has no connection to magic?
That's for sure.
Okay, why do you say that?
For sure, because we have two cups.
Yeah.
To say that
it would look like little balls under it or something.
There's no.
Are there balls under it or not?
If you see two cups and draw the conclusions, that is the trick.
Okay.
Then you should draw the same conclusion everywhere where you see two cups.
That's
nonsense.
I understand. So,
and then we have, at the left-hand side, we have some agricultural scenes. On the right-hand side, we see some people playing games.
Yes.
And in the middle, there's this scenery with these two cups.
Okay.
On the right-hand side, we have some written words which says that they are playing. On the agricultural side, we have also some texts which says okay, agriculture,
doing.
And here we have nothing.
Okay.
We have only a translation, one on top of the other. And that's what we see there. We have actually four cups, not two, but four cups.
Mm-hmm.
So one on top of the other, each side. So if that is a game these two people play,
right,
or whether it is baking breads, which I do not believe, and then it would be a text about that.
So you don't
but
think it's...
no magic. No magic at all.
You think
forget
it's no magic
that.
And you don't think it's baking bread either. So
no.
What do you think it is?
No.
But
it's only a hypothesis.
But what is your thought? What do you think it is? What were they doing?
I cannot say.
Okay.
I have no idea.
No idea.
Well, that's typically in science.
Yeah.
There are many things you do not know.
Yeah.
And you have to take the burden not knowing what's going there.
And just accept that.
And that, of course.
Say you can't
know
everything.
That makes sense.
Sure.
Just to put hypothesis in. That doesn't make sense. If there are other evidences around that, that makes it likely that we have here a bakery or a trick performance.
Right.
Then an hypothesis makes sense. But simply from that picture, without any evidence around that, useless. It's not an hypothesis, it is speculation.
Speculation.
It's a speculation, and scientists
avoid
that.
That's not science.
No,
speculation is not science.
That's not science.
Because you have to have proof. Basically,
there's absolutely no proof,
neither
for the cups and balls hypothesis or the bakery hypothesis.
Mm-hmm.
So we should not talk about that.
That's interesting. Okay, so that will dash the theory where a lot of people are saying, or particularly in their conversations, they're trying to go back.
Actually, and that idea came from an early Egyptologist who knew the thimble rig.
Mm-hmm.
Not the cups and balls. Thimble rig, you know, is
thimble
not
rigs.
The cups and balls. Thimble
yeah.
rig is different. Thimble rigging is completely different.
Mm-hmm.
But this guy knew the thimble rig from London or from England. And therefore, his idea, well, maybe it's thimble rigging.
Okay.
That was the original idea. And in about 1837, it was published in an Egyptology book of that time. But already in 1893, another Egyptologist put a thick question mark behind the thimble rigging hypothesis.
So what is your idea? What do you think is one of the oldest, or is the oldest recorded trick?
The oldest recorded trick usage, not a performance, that I can say exactly. It's 1145 before Christ.
Okay.
That is the record of a sort of investigation of criminal priests.
What? Okay.
In Egypt.
Okay.
And also again in Egypt. And yeah. These priests, they were real criminals.
Okay.
Murder, arson, and so on. Okay. And they forced the oracle. So they used tricks in the oracle business. Mm-hmm. That is the very first record we have about the usage of tricks. Not magic tricks, of course, because the purpose was not entertainment. The purpose was to fake oracles, to make oracles. They played God, let's say that.
I've seen some drawings like that where they have like a tube or something. It goes up the oracle.
Much later.
Oh, that was later. Okay. Well, how did they fake that back then? How did they make that a trick? I mean, how did they make the oracles?
You have to know the principle, how the Egyptian oracle worked. It is normally...
But it was supposed to talk, right?
No. Normally, an oracle is more or less a process which invokes accident. And the outcome then says what the gods will tell you.
Okay.
So if you draw some stones there and then you look, if you look for the birds flying, that was the Greek...
A certain way.
That is more or less accidental. And then you can draw conclusions. The Egyptian oracle was completely different. Several priests, at least four, maybe more, they took a litter or a beer.
Oh, that was what you... beer. Okay.
A beer. This in the Egyptology literature, I have read beer, quite sure. So a beer, and several priests took the beer onto their shoulders, and on the beer there was a statue, a heavy statue of a god in a house, because it was not allowed for the normal people to see the god. So it must be inside a cabinet.
Okay.
So and then they worked with that beer in front of several options, maybe it written papers. Mm-hmm. Should I do this? Should I do that? And if the beer is nodding, that means yes.
Yes, okay.
If the beer is going back, that means no.
Okay.
So, and if the beer is carried by several priests, then there is no accident. And if the beer is really heavy, then one of these guys have to give the signal what to do. There is no accident.
Right.
So it's very easy to do that. And the Egyptians knew that. And therefore, there are records that they were forced to exchange
places to hold the beer.
Yeah. So that nobody knew in advance who will be the leader of the oracle business at that day, just to avoid trickery. So they were fully aware
that they could be tricked.
So.
Is it just a matter like where one of them might move it a little bit? And I mean the litter they were carrying.
I did not try that, of course. But when I was serving at the army, I had to carry at one time heavy beams.
Okay.
Heavy wooden beams. We were about 10 people or so, and it was only possible in economic way if there was one guy among us, maybe the first or the last, who gave the commands.
Yeah.
In what direction, down, up, and so on, because they were very heavy beams.
Yes.
And that's a parallel to the oracle beer. So without these commands, there's going nothing.
Mm-hmm. And so that goes back, and so they were actually tricking people. And conning them, I guess, is a better way of putting it.
They were tricking people,
for money.
Uh-huh. And here it is recorded. It is recorded in that papyrus in 1145. It's stated exactly 1145 before Christ that they tricked the people.
Right.
And that is the oldest record of a usage of a trick, not for entertainment, however.
What about, and I'm thinking about this, and some might think this is a miracle, I think it's a trick, when Moses went to talk with the Pharaoh, and the Pharaoh had his magicians, court magicians, to change into their staffs into snakes,
and
then Moses changed his rest. So it's something documented back then, but I again feel that's kind of a story, but the point is the story exists, true or not, in the Bible of something. Would that have predated the...
No, certainly no. not, because you have to... I've looked for that.
Okay.
Because it's placed in Egypt, of course.
Yeah, that's right.
So
yeah. All
court,
this happens in Egypt.
Yeah. And you have to know that serpents or snakes were quite common there.
Of course.
So it was a problem even at that time to get snakes out of the houses.
Mm-hmm.
So because they were dangerous, of course.
Yeah.
And there was a whole business to handle snakes.
Mm-hmm.
That was nothing special for the Egyptians. And therefore, the topic of snakes is quite normal for them. So there's nothing special. So now you have to know we are talking about... how is this in English? It's not the Genesis part of the Bible, but it is...
That was an Exodus.
The Exodus, exactly. It's an Exodus, the story. Mm-hmm. The Exodus story is at the heart of the
yes,
Bible.
Right.
It belongs to the oldest parts of mm-hmm. the Bible. Mm-hmm. However, not this part.
Okay.
This special part is a late...
Edition?
A late edition, or a late insertion, actually. That story.
Into the Exodus.
Yeah, yeah. That story is a late insertion into the Exodus story, and it was inserted between 300 and 600 before Christ, not earlier.
So
it's 1,000 years after the papyrus Vestka.
Okay.
So it is a story, nothing else. So,
gotcha.
And of course, there is a hypothesis because it should be, might be possible to handle a snake in such a way that it gets
look
stiff.
Like a cane instead.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I've found one photograph of that effect,
mm-hmm.
but only not of the effect itself, but it was a photo where the author states in the 19th century that doing that makes the snake stiff.
Okay.
But that is the only record I have where this effect was really performed.
It's possible.
Yeah, if it's true.
If it's true.
If it's
I mean, I've
true.
Not seen or heard anything since yeah. then.
If it's true.
Verifying that.
It would be very nice to get more information about this really real effect.
Was that in a book that you had read someplace then? Or?
It is an old German book uh-huh. and without any reference, so you cannot check that whether it's true
Good point.
Or not. So,
yeah. It's like hearsay.
As a scientist, I say
you can't accept that as a scientist.
I do not accept that as solid proof.
Right.
It's an opinion, or maybe might be true, might be not.
Right.
And that makes things difficult. However, if that is possible, then an experienced snake handler would know that also in antiquity.
That's a good point.
And then, of course, the author of the story could have seen the effect anywhere and simply thought about the story and inserted it in the biblical story of Exodus.
Yes, right.
That's a very... I think
logical
mm-hmm. Conclusion or logical hypothesis. That is.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
So you have to know this is a late insertion into the Exodus story.
What are the kinds of things in Egyptian lore, I guess, is there that would indicate they had magicians? I mean, obviously that we've talked about some of those things, but in your studies, what other kinds of magicians have there been?
Of course, there were, but magician is, well, usually they were translated as magicians.
Okay.
But magician is, I think, not the good word for that, because magic was always used in antiquity, except Egypt, as...
A dark thing, a bad thing?
A bad thing.
Okay.
So magic is Greek.
Mm-hmm.
So, and magic in Greek and Roman antiquity was always bad.
Okay.
So, and later in Christian times, even worse, because they had the wrong faith.
Good point. Yep. They had the wrong faith.
In Christian times.
Sure, sure.
But also in Greek and in Roman times, magic, we have to avoid that.
Mm-hmm.
So, and why do we speak about magic in Egypt? Because the late Egyptian populations, they still exist today. The Copts existed in antiquity, and the Copts actually were converted Egyptians. So they were Christs.
Mm-hmm.
And they, of course, as Christs, they did not want to do anything
of course not.
With the old religion.
Mm-hmm.
And in the Egyptian religion, there is a force and also a god, the same name. The force is called Heka. And Heka is really some sort of natural force, like gravitation today.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, not in reality, but the Egyptians believed that this is real. And you could use Hekkar, this force, if you have the knowledge about the needed spell, and if you have the knowledge about the ritual. Both is needed to use Hekkar.
Okay.
If you know the ritual and the force and the spell, you can use Hekkar.
It's H-E-K-K-A?
H-E-K-A, exactly. Okay. So then you can use that. Hekkar was mainly used by the gods. They could do that, but mm-hmm. would also be used in the religious belief system of the Egyptian by humans.
Okay.
If they had the knowledge. Therefore, the spells, they're written in books and papyrus scrolls, they were secret. The normal population, those who are outside the temple, had no access to these spells because it was potentially dangerous use them. So, and this Hekkar actually was used by Jedi in the papyrus Vestkar.
Uh-huh.
So, and that is not magic because magic is simply different. Hekkar belonged to the quite normal worldview of the Egyptians. If you have the knowledge, you can use that. So, and you can make wonders.
So would Jedi been more of a counselor? I mean,
he was a priest.
He was a priest.
True, quite
okay.
sure he was a
okay,
priest.
Okay, then. That
However,
makes sense.
You have again to know, priests at that time is not like today.
Yeah.
At that time, there were the educated and the uneducated. If you were educated, then you were sometimes in your life a priest. Next, you were a general leading the army. Then you were in the government. That's it.
Okay.
So there is no priest as a profession in the sense. Of course, you are paid when you are a priest, but then you can change later. So there's not a special sort of caste.
It's not a job
It's not a caste.
Sure, I understand.
So,
like
at that time, India. The educated could do everything.
Okay, so they could change jobs.
Of course, and they did.
Okay, I see what you're saying. So he may have been that one day a priest one day and then the general the next.
No, not one day and next day, but after 2 years.
Sure. He could change to something else.
Yeah.
So
they go into the administration and vice versa.
Was he, again, working for or the pharaoh, Jedi, or is it a king, or who was?
That's a difficult part in the story.
Hmm.
Jedi is described as a very old man. His
right.
age was 110.
Okay. Yeah, 100, back then.
110 was the ideal age which could be reached in Egypt.
Mm-hmm.
So, and how should we interpret this? The meaning of the opinion of the Egyptologists is that says simply that is a very dignified person and nothing more. And at that age, you will not work any longer.
Okay, that's retirement age at 110.
Yeah. So I would say, yeah, that opinion is true. He simply retired some years before that.
Okay.
And he was called back to the court when he was already retired.
Because they respected him.
Yeah.
And he had dignity, as you said.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. Huh, interesting. So the court didn't have a, quote, magician because they didn't believe in magic at time.
They had these Hekkar priests, of course.
That was not considered, I mean, like entertainment magic.
No, of course not.
Did they have, this is kind of a different subject, but would you know, did they have court jesters who were like telling them jokes and things or juggling or anything like that? Nothing
probably
like that?
Not.
Okay.
Singers and dancers.
Yes.
But
not jugglers.
But no jugglers.
Or entertainers.
So, like that. We do not know. Let's say that.
Okay.
Because
so there's no scientific evidence
in the tombs of Beni Hassan, that is the place with bakers.
That was in Beni Hassan. That's the one. Not
Beni
Hassan. Beni Hassan. Thank you.
That is Beni Hassan. Is a region at the Nile Valley, exactly in the same tomb where this strange picture we find on the opposite wall, we see some sort of sports.
Yes.
And they also are juggling with balls.
Okay.
But that does not tell us that they are jugglers for whatever.
The court.
Maybe simply for leisure time. Because if you have such a tomb, you are very rich in Egypt. The normal population did not have that. So if you have a stone tomb, then you belong to the highest elite of the Egyptian.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah.
So it wasn't just the pharaohs who had the pyramids or whatever.
No.
There were others at certain levels that were
the
elite.
If you have a stone tomb.
Yes, of any kind.
You were rich.
I see. Interesting.
And if you have a stone tomb with such illustrations, then you were very rich.
Okay. Okay. Those illustrations, yes. The hieroglyphics and everything, because yeah. they were written, because it would tell about your life, I guess, basically, is what they were probably, I mean, where we have on our headstones, we have our name and everything. Yeah, but if they had a stone mausoleum, they yeah. basically had their life story on yeah. the walls.
They put more effort into their tombs than into their daily lives.
That's interesting.
Because they...
That was going to live beyond
for them. For them, it was sure... When they passed away, then a new life starts yes. in the netherworld.
Yes.
So, and for that, they prepared.
Okay.
If they had the opportunity, the financial opportunity.
Let's talk a bit about going to Aramis Boss then again, because it's a very fascinating, not only painting of the conjurer, and why would he necessarily have painted that when he was, as I understand, kind of an iconologist. He used to paint icons for the church and was yep. very involved with this. And at that time, then also, as I recall, that was when the church was going through some difficult times, I guess, in that area, in
exactly.
where he lived.
In that area.
Yes. And he comes from a family of painters, too. I think his brother was a painter.
It's
then?
His whole family.
Yes.
Yes. And we do not know whether he had his own workshop. He used the workshop, that's sure.
Yeah.
But we do not know whether it was his own workshop or the workshop of the family. No records about that. So mm-hmm. the time was difficult for the church, not actually at the time when Bosch, or Boss, Boss is the correct pronunciation right. in Netherlandish language. When Boss lived, the church was in trouble, of course, but it got really in trouble a few years later, because in 1520, about that, the Reformation started in Germany.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not so far away. Boss died in 1516.
Okay.
So a few years later, 4 years later, the Reformation started in Germany.
Because one of the things, or the theories I had heard about the painting, was that it was something to be said against the church because yeah. of their corruptness.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And that is the topic of the painting, at least in my opinion. But I have to say, I'm not an art historian, but I had read everything I couldn't get.
I have also. So
I read everything of the scientific papers about this painting yep. and yep. also about Boss.
Yes.
So to get knowledge about the painter and about all the things we have to know.
You have to understand his life. You're exactly yeah. right to understand why he would be painting
yeah,
that.
Course.
And so, that's why it kind of surprised me a little bit from the standpoint about how involved he was with the church. But then he was being paid then also for these paintings
yeah.
And everything. But then for him to kind of turn against that, to have this kind of political statement, if you would, with this yeah. kind of a painting against the church.
Yeah. I don't know why. I cannot say, but if you have a look at the painting, you have to first take into account that there is a pen drawing. It's
yes.
more or less the same topic.
I've seen that.
It is different.
Yes.
It's not the same.
A little bit different.
But it's the same topic, and there's
still the guy doing the cups and balls, or I mean
yeah, yeah.
whatever there.
So you see the,
yeah.
Actually there are two paint drawings.
Hmm.
And the second one, it was discovered not so long ago
okay.
by a Viennese expert, and he showed me the second one, which is the earlier one, and most likely they belong to one sheet of paper that was separated, and one is now in the Louvre, and the other is in Belgium, if I'm correctly informed. I have to look for that. And this is more or less a predecessor of the better pen drawing in Paris, in the Louvre.
Mm-hmm.
But if you look at the pen drawing, you see a very similar table.
Mm-hmm.
You see that... A crowd of people, you see the stealing of the purse.
Yes.
It's also included there. So there are so many parallels that we can say, okay, the guy who painted that pen drawing most likely painted also the painting,
mm-hmm.
or who made the drawing, who painted also made also the painting.
Yes, yes.
Or at the minimum, the painter of the painting knew that drawing.
And was inspired
this is
by that.
Also possible. And was inspired by that.
I thought about that.
But it is unlikely that this drawing was published, that was in the position of the
correct.
Of the artist.
Yeah.
And that was Boss. So at least in the opinion of the art historians, and they look for the stroke
mm-hmm.
and how it is done. And I'm not an expert in that field, of course, but I have compared several pen drawings, and I would say yes, that even for me, it looks similar. It looks similar, and so I have no doubt that they
one
are right
made by the other.
Assigning yeah. that drawing to Boss.
Sure.
And if that drawing is assigned to Boss, then the painting at least the topic, not the painting itself. That is sure. The painting was not done by the hand of Boss. That is sure. Mm-hmm. But my hypothesis is that it was either painted by the workshop, maybe even after the death of Boss. That's possible.
Wow. Okay.
Or it was painted by a member of the workshop after the death of Boss, who had knowledge about the oeuvre of the other Bosch Boss paintings. So,
okay.
So, and but I think it's more likely that Boss painted a similar painting, and this is a copy of that. That is the current hypothesis about this painting. It's not made by Boss himself, that's for sure. It's not the style of the painting is not the hand of Boss. We know that for sure now. But the topic and also the group of the spectators looks very like Boss. So that was the reason actually why it was attributed to Boss, because it was more or less discovered in the mid of the 19th century. Mm-hmm. And then the art historians thought that looks like Boss.
Right.
So there's no record that is belonged to Boss. So that's
it.
And now back to the question. Boss was revolutionary at that time. Also these sketches he made, for instance, the juggler.
Yes, right.
That was not in use at that time. At that time, the artists, they made drawings not from the normal life, but in the studio, just to learn,
yes.
Just to have some models for later paintings. Boss was one of the first, and the juggler is not an exception. In that case, it's not the only one. Who's one of the first who draw after nature.
Now, when you say the juggler, we're referring to the conjurer. Some refer to that.
Juggler. Juggler is better.
Okay.
Juggler
are two separate.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Why that? Because in the Middle Ages or late Middle Ages, we are talking about late Middle Ages or the end of the Middle Ages, there was no conjurer. Conjurer is a modern term.
Okay. So they just changed the name of that later. Okay.
At that time.
Oh, it is the same painting, just different name.
At that time, okay. Juggler in the English language, in German, Gaukler, that's exactly the same word. In Netherlandish, Goochelaar. And it comes from the Italian, actually. Originally, it comes from the Latin language. There's the joculator. Joculator, gaukler, juggler, it's all the same word.
Okay.
And the Italian language is also very similar.
Okay.
So at that time, there was no conjurer.
Mm-hmm.
So conjuring at that time, even if the word existed, mentioned the true
magicians. Something like
magicians.
Escamotier?
Later.
That was later.
That's
too.
Later.
Okay.
It's a French word, later.
Yes.
So,
and so that is
at
one.
At that time, juggler is the best term for that.
To explain what that is.
Yep.
Okay, I understand. And for those who are listening and not knowing what we're talking about as far as the political statement,
yep.
Explain that then a little bit in your words.
Yeah.
What was going on with the church and why he was...
When we accept that Boss was innovative in his art.
Very innovative, right.
So then we can also assume that he looked and he was had a bright mind. That's very sure. Mm-hmm. That's very sure. They had a very bright mind. And it is possible that even if he was a faithful Christ, which is documented that he was.
Yes, he was.
Even if he was that, it was possible that he criticized the church.
Mm-hmm.
There are two parallels. First, Erasmus of Rotterdam. Erasmus from Rotterdam.
Rotterdam.
Who was a faithful Catholic Christ
mm-hmm.
until the end of his life. But he criticized the church very, very sharply. Mm. I ask you to read his book, The Praise of the Folly.
The Praise of the Folly. Okay.
Very famous, not too very thick. It's a small booklet, and it is a criticism of the church of that time. Very, very sharp criticisms.
Mm-hmm.
But Erasmus was a faithful Christ.
Yeah.
He had nothing against the faith. He had something against the priests. And it is possible, this we do not know, but it is possible at least, that Boss had a very similar opinion about several parts of the church.
Right. Because they were taking money from people and
exactly.
Yeah, that was before they had the nailing on the door.
And the second example is Martin Luther.
Yeah.
He was a faithful Christ. Mm-hmm. He was a faithful Christ until the end of his life. Mm-hmm. But he was really in anger about the Catholic Church.
Correct.
And that sparked the Reformation. That sparked the Reformation. So to be a Christ is not in contradiction. We have two proofs here. To be a Christ is not in contradiction to criticize the institution, church, or at least some of the people inside the church. In that case, we have here the monk who stands on the left-hand side of the painting. There is no contradiction, and therefore we can take it at face value. It is a criticism of the time.
At the time, right? Yep. Well, I'm surprised then the church didn't condemn that or have it destroyed or something. Was it no big deal at the time?
Reformed Christ destroyed very many paintings a few years later. And that is the reason why we do not have so many bust paintings, only a few.
So there were more that probably existed until then.
Probably we know that.
Okay.
We know from the records that there are other paintings. We do not know where they are. So, and it is very likely that they are simply, that they were destroyed.
That's right.
So
wow.
They took the paintings out of the churches and they burned them.
Right.
Everywhere.
I mean, there are so many symbolic things in that painting. I think the crow that was on the fence that's cawing.
It's not a crow. It's some sort of bird.
It is some sort of bird.
You have two birds, actually. One is
the owl. There's an owl. One bird that's in his little gibberset. I think there's an owl peeking
out.
That's
an owl. Yeah, that's in the basket. But at the wall.
Basket, right.
There are two birds up there. Two birds. One is barely visible. You can make it visible by infrared light. So if you look at the painting,
with infrared light, you can only see it with an infrared light.
They use it, of course.
Mm. Okay.
The Boss paintings were examined in the last years.
So there's even more to the painting if you use infrared light. I've not seen that. Now you're opening my
eyes.
There are
two birds.
Wow. No kidding.
One is in the window. There's a cuckoo or cuckoo.
A cuckoo.
One is the cuckoo.
Yes.
And then beside that, very visible, is a small bird. And maybe, this is only an hypothesis, of course, maybe it's a symbol that the cuckoo tricks the bird.
Huh. Okay. Well, I can
then
see the symbolism.
Then we have the owl in the basket. The owl in the Boss paintings is always connected with a very negative meaning. Always.
And the same thing with the frog. Didn't the frog
and
have
the frog is similar. It's the same. So by that, when Boss or the painter from the Boss workshop puts an owl in the basket, which belongs to the conjurer.
Yes.
Then the conjurer is.
So he's bad.
Showing a very bad person. And if you look at the face of the conjurer, that is, in my opinion, a masterpiece. You see this sly, but that's a person you will not have as a friend.
Anything to do with. Right. But there were a lot of people who were obviously crowded around and watching this whole thing.
Of course, the effect is interesting.
Yes.
Of course, the show is interesting. But the performer is...
Okay. So the frog that's coming out of the cardinal's mouth or the priest...
Not the conjurer.
No, not that. I said cardinal.
Yeah.
The cardinal, the guy who was dressed in red, the pope,
woman.
But it's what?
It's a woman.
It's a woman. Oh, it is.
Yeah,
okay,
sure.
I thought it was...
Not for sure, but most likely.
Oh.
Because you can...
Because I was thinking of the nun next to him where this person was
but
a woman, definitely.
That's definitely, but she
But the one in red is woman too.
Yeah, because... Oh. And the reason is, if you have a look at the clothing, you can make that conclusion, that's a woman. If you look at the face, you cannot make a decision.
No.
So I did it. I took the face out of the painting. I painted it. I turned it
three-dimensional.
In vertical position. Mm-hmm. And if you look at the face without anything else, you cannot make a decision. But the cloth.
The clothing.
The clothing, yes. Mm-hmm. The clothing clearly characterized this person as a woman.
See, because I was thinking that, of course, the cardinals wear long red dresses and everything in the Catholic Church, but that's still a woman, you're saying.
It's more or less a rich woman because there's the key there, and that's, of course, on the purse.
I thought the key was supposed to be like St. Peter's, like the key to the Vatican something.
Of course. That is typical for art. You have several layers, and you are free to interpret it.
Mm-hmm.
That is typical for every art. So it's not yes and no. It's not black and white.
And the child who was reaching up, as I thought, supposed to indicate being Christ. Is that not right either?
I don't know.
Not necessarily, if not
true. It has a toy in his head.
He has a toy, but it was like a crucifix, wasn't it, or something? No, what was that?
It is some sort of windmill.
It was a windmill. Sorry, you're right. Yes, it was a toy like that. Yes.
But of course, you have the staff, then you have these two pieces of the right-hand side and to the left-hand side. You can interpret that as some sort of a cross. Mm-hmm. So, and then you can interpret that as Christ as a child, but right. This is simply your interpretation. It's not sure. There's no sign that should be interpreted that way.
Now, you were talking about the monk that was over there. There was something, talk a little bit more about that, mm-hmm. Because there was something else going along with the fact that Boss was part of this monastery or
No, not something, monastery. No? He was... That again is a proof that Boss belonged to the elite at that of his time, because he was among the sworn brothers.
That was it, brotherhood.
Sworn brothers of the Brothers of Our Lady.
Okay.
So, and the sworn brothers, earlier and later, were not artists. That mm-hmm. was the Duke of Burgundy and his surrounding. These people, they belonged to the sworn brothers. That Boss, as an artist, got access to this elite that was some sort of, it is strange. It mm-hmm. says he was very rich, which is proven. We know the tax records. He belonged to the highest,
yes.
To the richest people of Sartorin Boss. But even that income was not sufficient to get into that circle. So, and the art historians think that there must be some support by the very rich. We know that the Duke of Burgundy ordered a painting by Boss. So that means the Duke of Burgundy knew about Boss first, and he valued Boss as a very good artist, and maybe this was a way to get into that circle. Mm-hmm. If you are part of the surrounding of the Duke as an mm-hmm. artist, mm-hmm. then it might be a possibility to get into this elite circle of the Sworn Brothers.
This hierarchy.
Yeah, of them.
So that's interesting. To kind of wrap up over here, one thing I thought was very interesting, although I've never seen the painting itself. It's very small. It's only about 24 inches size. Or something, so, by 18 or whatever.
Not larger.
Very small.
I've seen it twice. Once at the European Magic History Conference in 2013 or 11, I'm not sure, I have to look for that, in Paris. And our Paris friends arranged that the painting was on display, because normally it is not on display.
Right, it's put away.
It's put away for security reasons, mm-hmm. because it was stolen once and they want to avoid that. So therefore, normally you cannot see it. And the second possibility was in 2016. There was a large exhibition in Sartorin Boss, actually, on the occasion of the 500th anniversary of the death of Boss. And there it was again on display. So, and therefore I've seen it twice, because if you're connected with that painting, then you want to see Boss, the Boss painting.
I am.
I was in Madrid. Did you ever visit Madrid?
I have been to Madrid in the Prada.
You did see the Boss paintings, the original.
I didn't at the time. I wasn't interested. This was back in 1972, and I wasn't.
You have to do that. If you have the chance, go there. There you see the Garden of Earthly Delights is sent there.
The triptych. Yeah. That's a whole other thing we could talk about, the triptych. It's amazing
to
go see.
If you are there, you have to go to the monastery. And it's not in Madrid. It's about 100 kilometers away, the Escorial.
Escorial.
You have to go to the real Escorial, not to the Escorial by Juan Tamariz.
You
have to go to the real Escorial. There you see other Boss paintings.
I was about to say that, as I understand, and correct me, Stefan, if I'm wrong, but there is more than one of these paintings of the Conjurer. There's one that was in Madrid.
There's one. There's the Garden of Earthly Delights.
No, I'm talking about just the Conjurer. Isn't
there
what they're...
There are several later copies.
Yes.
But not by the workshop of Boss.
Oh, it was not?
No.
Okay, I thought there were two or three.
Yeah, yeah.
Because there were another museums. I want to say one in New York, perhaps, even.
The first copy is, but this is only a copy of the composition. That's an engraving, actually.
I see.
By another Netherlandish artist. And there we have this sign at the table. There is a description, Hieronymus Boss.
Mm-hmm.
So, but that says the composition is by Boss.
Yeah.
Maybe. Because at that time when this engraving was made, many fakers faked Boss paintings.
Yes.
And faked also Boss drawings.
I can understand
and that. And it could possibly be that even that drawing is a fake.
Fake. Okay.
So it is unfortunately not a proof that the composition of the painting is made by Boss. It is likely, but it's no proof.
More than likely. Very interesting. So. Very interesting. Well, this has been fascinating. I mean, I love a deep dive into this. This may not be everybody's cup of tea,
no.
But this obviously is something that you and I certainly enjoy. And for those who are listening to this, by the way, we don't have a picture of this in front of us. It's just that we know so much about this painting. We're talking all the details and things over here. Absolutely fascinating, Doctor. I appreciate this very much of our time here together. And if people want to find out more information about you and about how that they might be able to go into, how can they get in touch with you? Or you got a website?
I have a website, of course, steffentaut.de.
Okay, but that's
steffentaut.de. But on my website, there's not so much information. A little bit of information about me, about my performances in magic, because mm-hmm. I'm also a performer. It's not my profession, but I perform regularly for decades already. But not about this topic. And
but do you teach you at a university or teach someplace?
I'm in the administration. So
okay.
I'm a nuclear chemist. That's my profession.
That's what your doctor is for. Interesting. Nuclear chemist.
Before that, I have my title.
It's just that your passion is about this.
That's really a passion for me, yeah.
Yeah.
So,
well, the name of my podcast is called The Magic Word. And so the Magic Word podcast, I always like to end my podcast by asking my guests what it is that's important to you. I mean, when I say I would like to know what your magic word is, I don't mean like abracadabra or whatever. Nor particularly just a word. What is your philosophy of life? What is it that you live by that's important to you?
If I take the whole life, I would say put effort in the things you like.
Ooh, I like that.
Do not do it superficially.
Uh-huh.
Just
dig deep.
Dig deep.
Yeah.
And then you have fun.
Wow. You don't know how much fun you're going to have until you actually start digging deep to find that real treasure. And then there's so much.
That's it.
Yeah.
That holds true for my profession.
Mm-hmm.
I was lucky to have, long time ago, a very, very interesting topic. Now I'm in the administration. It's different. But even there, if you take administration serious,
mm-hmm.
then it fills you. Then
of course.
You have some sort of
that passion fills you.
Yeah. The same was true for magic.
Mm-hmm.
I perform tricks that are not easy to perform. One of my all-time favorite is the cups and balls. And you know, if you want to perform the cups and balls, it's not easy.
No, it takes time.
It's not that takes time. But if you master that, then you have a good feeling in yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And the same holds true for the historical, investigation of these historic pieces.
Right, right.
If you go deep, then you get something new.
Very good. You go deep, you get something new. You're going to uncover something. That's true. Although I don't want to get into this, we could go into Hofzinser because I
know that's not my topic.
That's Richard Hatch's the topic,
that's
certainly.
Not my topic.
But someone again historically from Germany, in which that was influential, I think.
For me.
So no, that's not the right question. I'm just saying that's something that would be another. We could go off, talking about that and some other things, for a long time too. I appreciate the opportunity to get a chance to chat with you over here, and I think that the listeners also got something out of this then as well and learned a little different aspect of our history as well. And you've introduced me to some things. Thank you very much.
And,
I appreciate
you for the opportunity to share these thoughts.
You're welcome.
With others.
So for the Magic Word podcast, that was Dr. Steffen Taut. This is Scotty out. Thank you, Dr. Taut, for speaking with us this week and for giving us a deep dive into some of the history of magic and the history of the art of magic then as well. This has been a rather esoteric diversion, which I have really, really enjoyed a lot. And I think the listeners might be wanting to learn more about that. And I'm sure if they do a deep dive, they will find some great results also, because as you said, that if actually people dive deep, you're going to find something new. And that's true about anything, I guess, if you just find something that is your passion and follow that. But anyhow, it was fascinating. And I enjoyed chatting with you. And I look forward to getting together with you again sometime and going deep and talking about a little bit more about the juggler or the conjurer. And I also want to give a special shout out and appreciation again to my good friend Richard Hatch, who had put us together. So this way we were able to put to have this chat brought to you here this week. Well, enough for me. I appreciate everyone tuning in from week to week, and I hope that you like, share, and subscribe and do all those kinds of things. One of the things I haven't mentioned in a few weeks, and you might have noticed, is I really haven't announced many people who have become friends of the Magic Word, because we haven't had really anybody who has donated nor pledged anything new recently. So we could certainly use your support. I want to again say how much I do appreciate that and need your financial support in order to keep this podcast going from week to week. And also, if you can't give us a financial pledge of some sort, then perhaps you can take a few moments of your time just to give us a 5-star rating and some nice comment over in the iTunes store. It's been a few months since we've last had something posted there as well. So we certainly could use that, because that helps our podcast to grow. And don't forget, of course, if you buy anything on Amazon, be sure to go and use the link that we have at themagicwordpodcast.com. It's at the bottom of every page. Just click on that and it will take you to your Amazon page, and that way you can order or buy whatever you plan to buy anyhow. So when you're going to be buying something, go through the Magic Word Podcast first, so this way that we get a couple of pennies back from some of your purchases. Just don't forget that. So we appreciate the love you share with us, and we also appreciate the time that you've given us here this week. So until next week, stay well, get booked, and remember to put effort into the things that you like. This is Scotty out.